AstronomyCast episode 485, Docking and Refueling. Welcome to AstronomyCast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. I'm Fraser Cain, publisher of Universe Today. With me, as always, Dr. Pamela Gay, the Director of Technology and Citizen Science at the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, and the Director of CosmoQuest. Hey, Pamela, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Fraser?
Good. And at the time that people are listening to this episode of AstronomyCast, you may very well be at or near the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, right?
Oh, man. So when's this one going out? I will be almost to the ASP. I am in the middle, I realized, of 8 weeks, 8 cities, 4 continents.
I am impressed that you've been able to find the time to be anywhere near your house and to be able to record these episodes of AstronomyCast. And I know the people who join us on the live shows, they don't know whether they're coming or going. They don't know what time it is.
I don't know what time it is. I have no idea.
People who never get a chance to see our episodes live are able to watch them. People who normally watch them live can't watch them. It's a mixed up crazy world right now.
Well, thank you for playing along with me.
No problem.
It all ends soon.
It all ends. And then you'll be back home forever.
Yes. No.
All right. It's one thing to get to space, but once you've made it there, what do you want to do? You probably want to dock with another spaceship, deliver cargo, refuel. And today we're going to talk about how all that happens. One of the most fascinating times of the history of sort of NASA's space missions for me was the Gemini. And or Amy's your title was called the Gemini, but I was called the Gemini, even though she's Canadian too. Anyway, Gemini is the way you say the constellation, right?
Yes.
Right. My dad's a Gemini. Anyway, one of the great things about the Gemini missions was how they did this really incremental approach over the course of the missions, learning to stay up in space longer and learning to dock spacecraft together, which was the foundation of going on the Apollo program, because there was so much docking and flipping around capsules and stuff and landing and getting back to space and docking again. So let's talk about docking, which is, you know, if it's like the second riskiest part of spaceflight. If getting off the ground, maybe re-entering the Earth's atmosphere are the two risky parts. Let's talk about docking.
So this is my favorite bit of space history. Because the first poor American schmo who attempted to dock didn't know orbital mechanics and failed absolutely, totally, and completely in the most spectacular of fails. And it's because it turns out the way you have to maneuver is as counterintuitive as it can possibly be.
Wow.
You see that thing straight in front of you, intuitively, pretending you know nothing. What do you think you have to do to catch up with that spacecraft in front of you?
You aim towards that thing and you fire your thrusters and have it get closer to you.
Yeah, and that totally doesn't work, which is why they failed so delightfully spectacularly. So back on June 3rd, 1965, U.S. astronaut Jim McDivitt on Gemini 4 made a go of trying to catch up to his Titan II launch vehicle's upper stage. Seemed like not too bad a thing to do. Seemed like it should be easy. And the problem is, as we discussed in our last episode, when you fire your thrusters, when you increase your orbital velocity, what actually happens is you go into a higher orbit. You don't accelerate on the orbit you're on. You switch to an entirely new orbit.
So by aiming his spaceship at the target, and by firing his thrusters, he moved further away from the Earth.
And slowed down.
And slowed down. Which is absolutely right. It is so counterintuitive, right? They're like, yes. You know, you would be rising up higher. You would be seeing that Titan upper stage moving faster than you in orbit. And then you would, of course, now you would aim your spaceship in the direction of where the booster is now, and you would fire your thrusters again.
and just make the situation worse.
Just make it worse. Okay.
So this is one of those things where you really have to drop into a lower orbit, catch up, and then perform a Holman transfer orbit to get up into the orbit you're meant to be in initially, going at the same velocity as the thing you hopefully don't hit.
So how did they then figure this out later on?
They went back to Earth and they learned orbital mechanics. And I wish that it wasn't as... I mean, I sound totally sarcastic when I say that. I sound like I'm making fun of them. But no, this is what actually happened. They had to come back to Earth having failed to dock Gemini 4. They went to the notebooks. They did the math. They realized Kepler's laws... That whole equal area in equal time thing totally, totally kicked them. And then, like, ran some paper and pencil simulations because it was the 60s and figured out, oh, okay, we need to, like, be in a lower orbit and increase our velocity to bump up and slow down and, like, then touch and, yeah. Stomach wrong.
It's funny, right? Because when you, like, just think this through your brain, I mean, I think you really set the stage nicely. When you imagine how you would go about this process, when you think about how, say, when the Dragon launches on a SpaceX and it's going to launch to be able to deliver cargo to the International Space Station, it's got some certain window, you kind of imagine, right? The space station flies overhead and then the Falcon takes off and it's got the Dragon capsule on the front and it gets pushes it into this orbit that's exactly the same as the International Space Station. And then the Dragon has some little thrusters and it just puff, puff, puffs its way and catches up with, and that's the way people even describe it, right? Catches up with the space station and then docks. But that is not how it works.
And what's really cool is if you ever watch the videos, you get to see the Dragon capsule come from a much lower orbit, rise up in altitude as it catches up with the International Space Station, and then it adjusts its orbit. So they're essentially station keeping until they grab onto each other.
Right. And you used to see that with the space shuttle as well. You would always see these images of the space shuttle rising up below the International Space Station with the Earth behind it. So it's great. That's kind of counterintuitive. And so then for every maneuver that you're trying to do, you've got to go through some permutation of this, right?
And it becomes really a game of circularization at the right moment in time. This is where the whole idea of station keeping comes in. And it sounds like something totally out of Star Wars, where you have some stormtrooper standing next to a desk. But what station keeping actually means is putting yourself in a orbit so that you are maintaining equal separation with time with the object that you are interested in. So later on, like you said, the Gemini missions did things increment by increment by increment. So with the Gemini 6 and 7 missions, they weren't set up to actually dock and let the astronauts go back and forth between the two spacecraft, but they did want to station keep. And Wally Schirra did the piloting. This was back December 15th, 1965. And did that drop into a lower orbit and put yourself into an elliptical orbit such that the point where you catch up with the other spacecraft, you can then fire your engines and not catch up, but you go from that elliptical orbit that's about to hit them to circularizing your orbit or putting yourself into the exact same elliptical orbit. It depends on what orbit you're catching up to. You match orbits just at the last minute as you're about to pass each other. So it's not catching up. It's crossing orbits and then sinking your orbits. And he was able to get the Gemini spacecraft so that they were only about 30 centimeters apart, hanging out, orbiting together. And that's really impressive if you think about it. 30 centimeters is like the lower arm of most adult humans, and that's how close these two spacecraft were orbiting.
And what's so amazing, of course, is that he had to do this all by hand. Now, it's all done mostly by computers, but a lot of the early astronaut pilots, they had to do this all by hand, and they didn't have the benefit of video games that would have very easily simulated it. You know, if they had been playing Kerbal Space Program, they would have been able to change their brains so that they could, you know, they knew how to make the spaceship go. I mean, man, like a, you know, when you don't use your telescope and you've got some image that's in the telescope and you want to bring it closer to the middle, because everything is flipped upside down, you have to think in a different way. And you learn to always, after a while, in the beginning, you're always moving the object in the wrong direction. And after a while, you figure it out. And then eventually, you're able to actually always do it in the right direction. And you can just imagine, for these astronauts, they just didn't get enough time to be able to really get good at it until they could come up with really good simulations. So that just makes me even more impressed that they just didn't have, you know, they couldn't play all these video games.
Sometimes when I'm prepping for the show, I learn things that I feel like I really should have known and totally didn't know. And one of those things is Buzz Aldrin did a PhD dissertation. And it just like completely escaped me that he was actually Dr. Buzz Aldrin, because you never hear him called Dr. Aldrin. But yeah, he totally did a PhD. And his doctoral thesis was titled Line of Sight Guidance Techniques for Manned Orbital Rendezvous. So what is now math that we do as part of playing Kerbal Space, what I might assign as a homework assignment in the age of computers, was Dr. Buzz Aldrin's doctoral thesis.
Now, let's talk a bit about some of the other orbital maneuvers that they have to do docking. So I sort of mentioned this briefly early on. Now, you talked about some of the Gemini program, but when they moved into the Apollo missions, they had a lot more of these kinds of docking and rendezvous that they had to do.
And this is in part because the configurations they needed their spacecraft in at different points in time varied. How you wanted to launch everything versus how you needed to separate to land on the moon versus how you needed to then remate your spacecraft to get back to Earth and then jettison a part of your spacecraft to finish getting back to Earth. It was this crazy circus trapeze act with no net or wires or swing, just the trapeze artists.
Yeah. And I mean, so they had to do one maneuver, one docking maneuver when they were in Earth orbit.
Yes.
And then they had to do, of course, you know, when they got to the moon, they would go into orbit around the moon, then they would detach the lunar lander. It would go down to the surface of the moon, and then it would come back up, and then it would redock with the command module for them to come back.
Yes. And so you have, at one point when it's taking off, you have your Apollo module is happily downwards with the big command module below. You then flip everything upside down. It was a lot more pieces that got lugged to the moon than what you may think about. Because when we go to the museum, we see the spidery beetle-looking lander. And then we see the triangular Apollo capsule. But there was a lot more. It was that whole command module that we tend to forget about. And they had to do gymnastics around that, essentially.
Yeah. Now, while the Americans were, you know, having their doctoral theses, astronauts learning and practicing the ways to do these orbital maneuvers, the Russians didn't trust their astronauts so much to be able to actually perform these maneuvers, and they turned everything over to computers.
Yes, and what's funny is the way they started their history of doing this. It actually, for them, goes all the way back to 1963 with the early Vostok missions. Now, there was no actual station keeping involved. It was funny to me. I don't know if it was funny to them. Probably not. So in 62, they launched Vostok 3 and 4 a couple days apart. Then in 63, they launched Vostok 5 and 6 a couple days apart, stuck them into identical orbits. And they weren't entirely identical orbits, and the idea was one would catch up to the other. That didn't actually happen. Instead, they went from about 5 kilometers apart to, over time, thousands of kilometers apart. And then we have silence on the matter for quite some time.
Right. But that idea of the Russians sort of, you know, as I said, you know, not letting their pilots do the docking, they just went to computers.
Right. So in 71, we had Soyuz 11, which didn't survive entirely, by which I mean it didn't survive, but it did successfully dock with the Salyut 1. So that was a good start to things. Of course, we had the Apollo-Soyuz mission that came later on in the 70s, which actually proved that imperial versus metric isn't the greatest problem that one could have, because the docking technologies developed by the Russians and developed by the Americans were utterly incompatible. So they had to build a docking unit to essentially translate between Russian hull and American hull. So there was that great docking episode. But since then, docking has really been that thing that means, hey, I'm going to a space station.
Mm-hmm.
And this is today's, and has been in the entirety of both our lifetimes, the primary goal of docking.
Is transfer cargo and astronauts to the International Space Station, return cargo back to Earth and astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
That is the vast majority of the orbital maneuvers. I can't think of any, apart from, say, Deep Impact and L-Cross, I can't think of many other times. There was, of course, or Rosetta and Philae, but I can't think of other times that...
There was Beagle, but these are all cases of spitting out a spacecraft, not...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm trying to think of examples where things docked in space, but really it's all, the vast majority is them arriving at the International Space Station.
And so this was with the Soviet Salyuts, this was with the American Skylab, then we had Mir, and the original Soviet idea of doing robotic docking has really been what's taken over since then, where we have Soyuz and Progress spacecraft automatically docked with Mir, the ISS has the KERS docking system, Europe has the automated transfer vehicle, and so it's really robotic after robotic after robotic system. And now with the International Space Station, we're continuing this originally Soviet, then Russian and European tradition of robotic docking. We have NASA's berthing mechanism rather than a docking port. But mission after mission after mission, nation after nation after nation, this is the direction we're going. Japan joined in with their transfer vehicle, and all the spacecraft are all set up to essentially robotically go into station keeping, pull that Gemini maneuver of hovering without touching. I'm not touching you. Basically, this is what you want your children in the back seat to do. Stay equally distance and not touch. And then the Canada arm reaches out and grabs the spacecraft. And so we've gone, and this just makes me giggle to no end. We have gone from robotic docking, meaning a fully automated get together and couple the spacecraft, to a automated hover, not touching, and then an arm reaches out and grabs that spacecraft. It's lovely.
It really is the safest way to go about it. All right, we've been talking about the docking maneuvers. Let's move on to the refueling side of things. So where is that happening right now?
So this is where sometimes science fiction makes things seem easier than the paperwork actually allows it to be. We've tested the technologies for doing refueling in space, and this is one of those things that's really on the long-term roadmap. As we look ahead to assuming the space launch system moves forward, its first several launches are going to go towards getting us a little tiny spaceport out in cislunar space that nominally will be there for construction and refueling. And as we work on the roadmap to get towards that little space station, NASA has been testing the robotic refueling mission. It hung out on the International Space Station until 2017. Early 2017, it came back to Earth. It was considered a success. It showed that we have the ability to safely have a fuel depot in space. We have the ability to refuel things. We're just not going to keep doing it for the time being because the space was needed to test other things.
I mean, one of the things that's kind of interesting is like when the Soyuz and the Progress vehicles dock to the International Space Station, they don't transfer the fuel. They don't transfer their propellant out of those vehicles. They just boost the space station by using the thrusters on the vehicle itself.
Yes.
And so I don't know if they transfer any propellant at all to the International Space Station, but all of the boosting maneuvers are done by these attached spacecraft. So orbital refueling is not something that's been done. But then, like, theoretically, it makes a lot of sense, right?
With the robotic refueling mission, it wasn't so much that we were worried about refueling the International Space Station, because really you just attach a new Dragon or Soyuz capsule to it. The real question is, what do we do with all of the other satellites out there that we'd like to extend their lifetime? We've totally upgraded the Hubble Space Telescope, giving it the ability to stay out there a little bit longer. Now, imagine if we had the capacity to go out, grab Kepler, and refuel that little telescope. This would extend the science it would be able to do. It has always been in the roadmap to be able to go out and grab satellites, move them around, pick them up when they're broken, bring them home. I remember I was a nerdy child who went to space camp in the 80s, as one does, and hearing the stories of how they were planning to build these highly maneuverable satellites that would go around, grab satellites that needed to be fixed, pick up space junk. We're just not there yet. It hasn't risen to being a high enough priority. But we are on the pathway to test the technology, to show that it's safe, to do all of the pathfinding that's needed before we finally have that docking station out in cislunar space.
And you can imagine some of the more complicated missions that are going to be attempted in the future, especially things like sending humans to Mars, are going to require this refueling. And I think the sort of example that people are pretty familiar with is the idea that's coming from SpaceX for the BFR. You know, the BFR is going to launch, and they've got the regular, the passenger version, and it's going to launch atop its first stage booster rocket and get into orbit. And then there's what they're calling the tanker, and it's going to be filled with methane. And then the two BFRs are going to sort of dock end to end, and then the tanker is going to dump all its fuel into the spaceship. And now the spaceship is as fueled up as if it was still sitting on the launch pad down on Earth, but it's in orbit. It's already gotten out of that accursed gravity well from planet Earth, and now it can perform its maneuver and head off to Mars or other destinations. So that strategy makes a ton of sense. And you can imagine this future where there are these orbital fuel depots in various orbits. You talked about the Deep Space Gateway, something in low Earth orbit, something at Mars. And if you need to go anywhere, you stop at one of these depots and refuel.
And really, I just dream of the day that all these beautiful, completely functional spacecraft that we have in fairly low orbit or are doing highly maneuvering things are able to get refueled, and our Kepler spacecraft that is still functioning quite nicely can keep doing its job without fuel being a reason to stop.
Well, there's actually some, I mean, you may not be able to actually refuel them, but there are some spacecraft that are being developed that are kind of like parasites that clamp on to satellites that are out of fuel, but are working perfectly well for all other purposes, and they will clamp on, and then they'll have a thruster and additional solar panels on them, and they'll be the ones who keep the spacecraft functioning. I think the greatest tragedy, and the one that people just can't stop raging about, is the fact that James Webb isn't going to have, you know, there's no way to refuel it. There's no way to repair it. it's going to be the L2 Lagrange point. It's got 10 years of fuel, and then it's going to drift out of its position and be useless. It does have a docking ring on it, though, so who knows what'll happen 10 years from now.
Can I just say I'm sad that the telescope won't live as long as it took to build?
Yes, you can say that. But there's hope. They do have a way for something else to attach to it and boost it. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody, you know, if the BFR does only cost $7 million to launch, I wouldn't be surprised if someone, you know, if Elon Musk with some pocket change sends off a reboost spacecraft to keep James Webb going for a few more decades.
Yeah. So we're currently in this meta situation as we record this episode where the U.S. government has nominally completed writing a $1.3 trillion budget that will get us through to September. They're supposed to vote on it on Friday, which is before you hear this episode. We're currently waiting to see, does W first live or die? What is the line item for James Webb Space Telescope? All these things. It's Schrodinger's budget at this moment.
All right, Pamela, thanks. I feel like we have wrapped up our series on getting to space and orbiting.
We have, yes.
My heart hungers for some cosmology now, so we'll tack in a completely different direction. But it was a lot of fun. I hope, you know, we were able to kind of scratch everybody's spaceflight itch for a little while. And thanks for tagging along with us.
And I think it's time for an update on particle physics.
Whoa, okay. We're going to go physics. Fine, no problem. I'm up for that.
It's all part of cosmology.
We'll see you next week.
Sounds great. Talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to AstronomyCast, a nonprofit resource provided by Astrosphere New Media Association, Fraser Kane, and Dr. Pamela Gay. You can find show notes and transcripts for every episode at astronomycast.com. You can email us at info@astronomycast.com, tweet us at AstronomyCast, like us on Facebook, or circle us on Google+. We record our show live on YouTube every Friday at 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, or 20:30 GMT. If you missed the live event, you can always catch up over at cosmoquest.org or on our YouTube page. To subscribe to the show, point your podcatching software at astronomycast.com/podcast.xml or subscribe directly from iTunes. If you would like to listen to the full unedited episode, including the live viewers' questions and answers, you can subscribe to astronomycast.com/feed/full-raw. Our music is provided by Travis Searle, and the show was edited by Chad Weber. This episode of Astronomy Cast was made possible thanks to donations by people like you. Please give by going to patreon.com/astronomycast.